Arizona is in a drought and has been for years, and that's led to calls for people to change their yards to desert. But people love their lawns.
If they wish to have their oasis, their escape from the day-to-day rigors of life, obviously that's a great opportunity to have an area where kids can go outside and play. And that's your escape from the demands of the outside world.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, some Northern Arizona forests are thinning out, efforts to help healthcare providers suffering from PTSD.
And Valley cities use newer tools to spur development, often in older parts of town.
We kind of have this old one-size-fits-all zoning, and it didn't really incorporate in most situations the type of mixed use that we want to see today.
Plus, what goes into an icon and B14? Anyone got B14?
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Look for partly sunny skies, breezy conditions for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 86 degrees. Partly cloudy skies tonight, slight chance of rain, overnight lows in the mid-60s. Mostly cloudy tomorrow, 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms and a high of 76 degrees. It's partly sunny right now, 84 degrees at KJZZ.
The Arizona Department of Transportation is testing a new method of detecting wrong-way drivers entering a freeway. As KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, this is one of the efforts the agency is launching after officials held an emergency meeting on the issue last year following a string of fatal crashes.
Officials are testing a set of wrong-way driver detectors along the Loop 101 off-ramps at Glendale Avenue and Peoria Avenue. ADOT spokesman Doug Ninsel says they're starting to show some promising results.
A consulting team also is conducting a separate study. They're gathering information about detectors and how they potentially could interact with warning systems, such as the overhead message boards along the freeways.
Ninsel says ADOT has also installed larger and lower do not enter signs along 45 additional state interchanges. However, he couldn't comment about how these projects would impact a recent civil lawsuit, alleging the state hasn't done enough to prevent wrong-way drivers from entering the freeway. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Another bombshell today in Judge Murray Snow's courtroom in the contempt case against Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Judge Snow announced there is new evidence the sheriff's office may have tried to discredit him by hiring a paid informant to prove an alleged conspiracy between him and the Department of Justice. And this revelation could have a major impact as Snow decides whether the sheriff should face criminal contempt of court. Joining me now is KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block.
Hi, Steve.
So, Jude, the judge's announcement today relates to the investigation done by the sheriff's confidential informant, Dennis Montgomery.
Right, and we've learned in the last few weeks the sheriff's office hired Dennis Montgomery when he was living in Seattle to do an unorthodox investigation and that he wasn't so credible. The mystery has been what exactly Montgomery was investigating. Today, Judge Snow told the courtroom that after reviewing Montgomery's documents, he believes Montgomery, along with some MCSO deputies, were trying to expose Snow himself and the Department of Justice were involved in a conspiracy to covertly investigate the sheriff and deny him due process in court.
So this is obviously pretty serious. How would this impact the contempt of court case against Sheriff Arpaio?
Well, keep in mind, the sheriff is facing civil contempt of court because he violated Judge Snow's orders in the racial profiling case. Arpaio's admitted to those violations. The real question is whether the violations were intentional, because if so, the judge could refer this to a prosecutor to pursue criminal charges against Arpaio. Now, if what the judge is saying is true about Dennis Montgomery's investigation, it could get into the question of whether the sheriff was willfully disobeying the court. The sheriff's office apparently hired Montgomery in the fall of 2013, right when Snow was issuing orders in the racial profiling case. And today in court, Snow actually said why at the moment the sheriff's office should have been spending resources implementing the court's orders, were they actually funding a confidential informant in Seattle attempting to, quote, construct some bogus conspiracy theory to discredit this court.
So it sounds like Judge Snow was not too pleased.
No, he was very serious and stern today. He said the monitor will start doing investigations based on what are in those Montgomery documents. And meanwhile, the parties will be meeting weekly until June. Then the contempt of court hearing resumes for 8 days.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Jude, thank you.
Thank you.
Go Governor Doug Ducey this afternoon is hosting what his office is calling a leadership summit. It's at University of Phoenix Stadium in Glendale. The event includes a panel discussion on education and talks by pollster Frank Luntz and others. The governor's spokesman, Daniel Scarpinato, says Ducey sees this as a chance to talk about how to make Arizona the ideal place to live, open a business, get an education, and retire, among other things.
This is a unique opportunity to get everyone under one roof, from Flagstaff to Tucson and everywhere in between, and not only talk about that vision, but hear from leaders who have succeeded at economic development and education elsewhere in the country. Listen and learn from them as we make our own policy decisions here.
Scarpinato says the governor expects the discussions to be candid and for there to be differences of opinion. For more on what the event is all about, I spoke earlier with Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services.
It's really got two focuses. Number one, the governor has invited in some educators from around the country to talk about their experiences, very different situations, whether it's New York or, let's say, New Orleans, how they've succeeded in the face of adversity. But this really, in some ways, is a pep rally. I think the governor would like to get all the economic groups together and put them on the same page in terms of going out and selling Arizona as a place for business. I mean, remember, this is what the governor said would be his number one job as developer-in-chief, if you want to call it that, during the campaign.
In your mind, what is the impact of an event like this? I mean, can this really sort of be an open marketplace of ideas?
Well, to the extent that there's some back and forth, it would have been nice had there been a broader group in terms of education. I mean, I think that you have folks in the education community, parents, teachers, heck, even the state school superintendent, who might have something to say about that, the universities. As far as the economic development aspect of it, as I said, I think that this is designed to get people to accentuate the positive and ignore the negative. I mean, we just had a headline, you know, recently about how much Arizona has cut from the university system. Those are the kinds of things that if a company is looking to relocate, they look at a state like Arizona and say, wait a second, you just cut $99 million and we're down to below $700 million in university funding, and we had been at $1.1 billion 5 years ago. Do I really want to bring a company here? And I think the governor would like a little less of that talk and a little more of what a great place Arizona is.
What do you expect to come out of this? I mean, are there tangible goals that you think the Ducey administration might be looking at and saying, yes, this was a success, or maybe no, it wasn't?
Well, aside from the fact that all governors, when they have a meeting, call everything a success, the question of how do you measure this becomes, does everyone get on the same page? Look, we have had this argument among, you know, Greater Phoenix Economic Council and the Arizona Chamber and the Phoenix Chamber and Southern Arizona Leadership about everybody wanting to claim credit and everybody going their own direction. And this has been a fight that's gone on for years. I think for a while, everyone will sing a little kumbaya and promise to talk about the positive. But until you deal with some of the underlying issues of relatively high unemployment, even several years after the recession has ended, until you deal with questions of the K-12 funding and will we owe $300 million, until you deal with university funding, until you deal with infrastructure issues, I think it's going to be a hard sell to simply say, well, we're just going to talk about the positive.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks.
You're very welcome.
Being a doctor or nurse can be a stressful job. Studies have shown healthcare providers are at risk for post-traumatic stress disorder and other mental health issues. But a Valley doctor is trying to get his colleagues to identify and deal with these kinds of conditions. Dr. Daniel Pacheco is an internist and chief medical officer at Banner Behavioral Hospital. He was previously a mental health therapist.
One of the common things you see in medicine is that the work never ends. So you're doing your shift at work, let's say emergency medicine, do 12 hours or more, depends on the volume, but it keeps coming. It's like the post office. You work up the patient, you see the patients, you clear them out, well, there's another 10 waiting to come in. And it's a lot of giving of the individual as a physician. You do that, you know, as a special service to serve your fellow man, but the giving never ends. Then you go home and take care of day-to-day stuff. Then you got to come back to work, and still there's a lot of expectations from you. You're always giving. There's a caregiver syndrome that's been documented, and a lot of it is the daily wear and tear on a provider, on a physician, that just continues to build up and if not dealt with appropriately can lead to burnout and other issues like that.
Do you tend to see that more in some specialties than others?
In some of the studies, if you look at, have shown that critical care and emergency medicine, which kind of makes sense, trauma, where they see more of the sicker patients that frequently pass away. A lot of codes or procedures where you're trying to save, literally save somebody's life. That can be very stressful, very hard, family in the room. You know.
So given what doctors and nurses and other providers do, how do you ameliorate that? I mean, how do you help them?
Well, in my role, what I try to do is, one, bring awareness to it. There's not a lot of, or now there is more, but there's still not a lot out there. 300 to 400 physicians a year kill themselves. That's several medical school classes that are wiped out. But what I'm trying to do is provide the doctors with a education on what can I do, whether it's mindfulness, cognitive behavior therapy like approaches, exercise. But the real thing is permission, quite honestly. Through our training, we're taught to deal with a lot because you have to. You're expected to always be the champion, the healer, the educator, the evaluator while you are on, and little wiggle room for taking care of yourself. And now I think what you're seeing is a whole shift in medicine, and kind of what I'm hoping to try to do is where the providers learn to take care of themselves. Healing the healers is what I do. I like to name my topic that I do is trying to help providers get to that point.
Is there a mentality among healthcare providers that you should just be able to deal with this?
Oh, yeah. There's that, you want to say superhero thing, but yes, it's actually encouraged.
There's also sort of the old saying that doctors often make the worst patients, that they don't do well when they're not well. Like they don't acknowledge it. They don't want to go see the doctor. I mean, is there an element of doctors and nurses and other providers just not recognizing that they're suffering from something like this?
Yeah, I think there's a level of either ingrained shame to admitting some weakness, and particularly with mental issues, with depression, with substance abuse. License issues come into play, livelihood. If I go see a therapist and they diagnose me with depression and I'm a physician, could this potentially come up to cause me problems later? And really, it's not the culture of itself also is not very open to it. It's you're a physician, you know, patients need to be seen, and patients do come first. And I think slowly, as the rest of healthcare is realizing, as we're losing providers, nurses, that we are human, we do have issues that need to be addressed, and it has to be addressed in real time. We do have a situation coming where if we don't take care of the healthcare providers we have now, who's going to take care of us and our future generations? Because there's a lot of physicians getting out, whether it's because of the electronic medical record or is it the rate of return of how much I'm putting into it and how much of a price am I paying? So I think just being aware and recognizing that we do got to change along with the healthcare system the way it's changing, but how do we take care of our providers? I think it's going to be very important in the next 10 to 20 years.
Dr. Daniel Pacheco is the Chief Medical Officer at Banner Behavioral Hospital. Daniel, thank you.
Thank you.
A few weeks ago, we brought you a conversation with Phoenix Councilman Bill Gates talking about efforts to revitalize the area around 32nd Street in Shea. The plan includes working on shops, restaurants, and streets, among other things, but one proposed project has some neighbors upset. It's on 32nd Street, a few hundred feet north of Shea. Right now, it's a single-story building with a vet and some other small businesses in it, but a developer is planning a five-story apartment complex.
I see a building that could use some TLC, but I certainly don't see a blighted neighborhood by any means.
Attorney Michelle Lombino has lived a little north of the site for almost 20 years. She and many of her neighbors don't like the new project called View 32.
By constructing a five-story apartment building in this area, you go against all that is the strength and promise of this area. A five-story apartment building would drastically change the character and composition of our neighborhood, and it does not honor all that is best in this neighborhood.
Basically, Lombino's argument comes down to the apartment building wouldn't fit in the area.
I think some of their points are really valid.
Michael Martindale with the brokerage firm CRA is working on the project. He says the area was built over the last 50 years and hasn't had a lot of new development since then, but he thinks this project would change that.
What we're trying to do is introduce 147 units of folks to an area to get not only some revitalization, but not for merchants and restaurants, which would be great, but these people are going to come, they're going to enjoy the neighborhood, I think they're going to revitalize it, and they're probably going to look around and want to stay and buy a new home.
The apartment building would essentially change the zoning on that piece of land using what's called a planned unit development, or PUD. Phoenix has been using them for less than a decade, although it had and other Valley cities still have other similar designations. Grady Gamage has been a zoning lawyer in Phoenix for 40 years and says PUDs give developers and landowners more flexibility and cities more oversight and control. And he says they're becoming more popular.
In an era when we want the city to become more dense, when we want it to become more mixed use, and when we want to see more creativity in the design and architecture, this is sort of the trend. This is where everything is headed.
Gamage, though, says they're not perfect.
The dilemma with it is, unlike the old style zoning, if you're a neighbor, you got to be really vigilant in paying attention to what's being proposed, because it's going to be very specific. And there may be aspects of it that are quite different from what was typical in the neighborhood before someone proposed a PUD.
Gamage expects developers to continue using PUDs. He says some really like them because of the flexibility they offer and are willing to invest money up front for design work before knowing if the plans will be approved. On the other hand, he says some developers won't use PUDs since they don't want to spend the money on a project that may not get approval. Wendy Riddell, a land use attorney with the firm Barry Riddell and Rosenstiel, says PUDs can be especially useful for infill projects.
We kind of have this old one size fits all zoning, and it didn't really incorporate in most situations the type of mixed use that we want to see today, that more sort of work-live-play concept, that urban living concept. And through the use of the PUD, you're able to develop those types of projects.
Riddell says the process for applying for a PUD is generally longer and more expensive than a typical zoning case, but she says they're a helpful tool.
I think what's particularly beneficial about PUDs is it really allows everyone from the community at large to our elected officials to look at the design that's proposed within the particular context in which it's proposed.
Riddell says PUDs can change things like how far back from the street a project is built, a parcel's use, and the height of a building. And it's that last one that has Michelle Lombino and her neighbors particularly upset about View 32. She's worried it'd obstruct the area's views of the mountains.
If the developer introduced something that was more in keeping with the current zoning and the current area, I'm sure that my neighbors and I would consider it.
But broker Michael Martindale says factors like height and mass are driven by economics. He says if the price were different, the project might be as well.
You need to get a level of mass to get things like financing and buyers at the end of the day for the projects. And at 147 units right now, we're frankly borderline. Getting much below that, the economics just, they don't exist.
The case was scheduled to be heard by the Phoenix Planning Commission this week, but at the developer's request, the panel held off on that until its June meeting. In the meantime, there's another neighborhood meeting planned to talk about the proposal. Still to come, the massive forest thinning project in northern Arizona is supposed to create a bunch of jobs in the region, but
they are skilled jobs. And I just have to point out that right now we are deficient in people who have those skills.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. Partly cloudy skies in the forecast for tonight around the valley, looking for a 20% chance for rain. Overnight lows still expected to be in the mid-60s. Then for tomorrow, a 30% chance for storms. And a high of 76, and then on Saturday we'll stay way below normal, again with a 30% chance for rain and a high of 78. Current weather conditions around the state include cloudy skies, 56 degrees at the Grand Canyon, clear skies and 64 in Prescott, Tucson with clear skies and 84. Here in the valley, relative humidity is at 18%. We have partly cloudy skies and 85 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by the Greater Phoenix Chamber of Commerce, presenting the La Vida Robot. Two local teachers behind the inspiring movie Spare Parts share how STEM education empowered their students. May 28th, tickets at phoenixchamber.com.
Living in the desert in the midst of an extended drought can lead people to change their decision-making process. For a lot of people who live in the valley, that has meant turning to desert landscaping around their homes and using xeriscape techniques to conserve water. Kirti Matura is a valley-based horticulturist.
Particularly going into the summer, if you've chosen the correct plants, to include in your landscape, you can get all the benefits of shade and ground cover that can conserve moisture and keep the sun from hitting the ground that's going to heat up.
Matura says the key is realizing xeriscape as a method for creating the most comfortable landscape for this region.
And I think too many people don't understand that it's xeriscape, not xeriscape. And they think that it has to be a minimalist type of landscape to be conserving water, and that is not what the goal is or the idea is.
Amber Lefsted is the WaterSense Outdoor Coordinator for the Environmental Protection Agency, which favors xeriscaping.
You can see even more efficient landscapes that incorporate rainwater harvesting or gray water processing, or use no supplemental irrigation, and have plants that are regionally appropriate and native. So we kind of promote all of those landscapes depending on where you are as a person and looking to incorporate water efficiency into your landscape. Of course, the landscape that needs no supplemental watering is the most water efficient and most drought tolerant, but not all people are ready for that. So we also promote water efficient landscaping that's just looking at irrigation system maintenance and more water efficient plant choices.
There are also people who've made the argument that, especially in a place where it is so sunny and so dry and so hot, that if you're wise about how you use, let's say, a green lawn, that may be, in fact, a way to keep the area cooler and, in our case, sort of fight the urban heat island. Are there any thoughts or studies on that that you could talk about?
With the urban heat island effect, definitely if you're replacing a landscape that's green, that is a planted landscape with hardscape that's impermeable, black asphalt, you're going to see an increase in the urban heat island effect. But if you're looking to replace a turf grass landscape or a landscape that's using a lot of water with a lower water using landscape, so looking at lower water using shrubs and ground covers and trees, you'll still see a benefit in lowering the urban heat island effect.
Do you think it's questionable then, especially in an area like Phoenix or, let's say, California facing such drought, that even if the water use is efficient and drinking water is not being used, it's still a relatively questionable use of water considering what current conditions are?
Yes, I do think that people need to pay attention to the current state of the water in their area, and that in times of severe drought where drinking water needs to be conserved, or where you're looking at drinking water versus landscape irrigation in those areas, the landscapes will suffer during those times if people have not planned for drought situations. So when you have a landscape that you've effectively designed for the climate, it's going to be able to survive a drought.
Amber Lefsted, WaterSense Outdoor Coordinator for the EPA. But what if you moved to the valley from the Midwest, or you're in a neighborhood well known for its green lawns and you really like how it looks? Aesthetics do play a large role in choosing where we want to live. Ryan Trudell is a director of landscape architecture for LVA Urban Design Studio in Tempe. He says choices and suggestions depend on the scale of the project.
If you're looking at a residential development or a residence that's up in, say, a North Scottsdale setting, that type of treatment of the landscape is probably going to be far different than, say, somebody that lives in the Southeast Valley. That's going to be a very different character of the general context of which they live in. Now, that's not to say that an individual that has, say, their backyard area, if they wish to have their oasis, their escape from the day-to-day rigors of life, obviously that's a great opportunity to have an area where kids can go outside and play. And that's your escape from the demands of the outside world. Now, as far as the front yards of a setting like that, you know, we're going to be a little bit more sensitive to those applications. And that North Scottsdale feel, a carefree feel, is going to be very different from, say, a Chandler or a Gilbert. Just a different, usually based upon the development of that area, some of the history of that area will really drive the feel of those aesthetics as well.
How challenging an area is this based on what we're talking about, this idea that, okay, you live in a certain place and there are going to be people who say, you shouldn't have a lawn here. But other people will say, well, if you maintain it correctly and if it really gives the character of a neighborhood, I'm thinking about some of the older neighborhoods, maybe North Central or Arcadia, those areas, there, the green lawn is almost associated with these places when there used to be the citrus groves and that kind of thing. So is there a dynamic that you look into as well, whether based on tradition versus developing something new?
Without a doubt, that's absolutely critical, and you hit that right on the head. In Arcadia setting, or say a Chandler or Gilbert, many of those communities, as a part of the CCNRs, as a part of the overall development and vision for that community, call for turf areas. It's like anything else in life. It has to have a balance. And if you're sensible about the use, if it's purposeful, if it's intentional, and it's not just a superfluous type of use of that resource, I think it's very worthwhile.
Have you noticed anything in the last couple of years that indicates there's a cycle going on right now where people are turning away from grass, at least temporarily, or they're looking for more of a combo?
We do. We are seeing there are still communities that really want to play up the very green, very vibrant setting. And we certainly can support that in certain situations. However, there are other areas where we can find more creative opportunities and applications for those amenities. Many times we use turf, especially in an area where we want people to gather and to congregate. If we're looking at a Chandler or a Gilbert, these are areas that in our recent history have been very highly family-oriented style communities. Mm-hmm. In these types of communities, with the price points where they're at, we're going to have a lot of young families, maybe move-up families, and there's going to be a high demand for outdoor recreation and amenity space. So for those types of settings, what we'll do is we'll embrace the use of turf. We want to be smart. We want to be conscious of the water and all the resources that we're utilizing. And we try to put those in areas that really get the most bang for the buck. It gets the most use for that community that we're building.
Ryan Tridell, Director of Landscape Architecture for LVA Urban Design Studio in Tempe.
It's the show on KJZZ. That's Steve. I'm Mark. And here's the takeaways, John Hockenberry.
The people who live around Camp David in Thurmont, Maryland, love their little piece of history.
It's a pride when you go somewhere and say, well, I'm from Thurmont, and people say, well, where is Thurmont, Maryland? Never heard of it. Well, have you ever heard of Camp David, the presidential retreat? Oh, yes. And then that puts us on the map.
But President Obama doesn't seem to be much of a camper. Of recent presidents, he's used the retreat by far the least, according to unofficial White House statistics. This is President Obama's first time visiting Camp David this year. Did Dick Cheney leave a big mess in his undisclosed location? Is it the bugs or something? Is it just too quiet for this president from Chicago? Alan Lichtman, political historian and distinguished professor of history at American University, says Obama may be the first president who is more impressed by the White House gym than the historic cabins of Camp David.
Well, Camp David has a fascinating history. It began in the 1930s as a project of the Works Progress Administration, which Franklin Roosevelt set up as part of his New Deal program to put people to work. But it also built useful things like this camp out in the Catoctin Mountains near Washington, D.C., which Franklin Roosevelt took as a presidential retreat. And he called it Shangri-La after that mythical, wonderful place in the Himalayas. And it was only named Camp David later, under President Dwight Eisenhower, who named it after his grandson and his father. Dwight Eisenhower very much liked to go to Camp David. So did Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, and George W. Bush were all quite fond of the retreat. George W. Bush spent more than 300 days of his two-term presidency at Camp David.
Why do you think Barack Obama seems to have some hesitation to head out to this serene retreat?
Barack Obama has not used Camp David very much as compared to prior presidents. Obama hasn't said why he hasn't used Camp David as much as others, so we have to speculate. You know, he's kind of an urban guy, and perhaps he likes cities better than the isolation in the rural area of Camp David. You know, he's got daughters who are kind of at the age where they're bored with everything. Maybe they find Camp David a little too quiet, a little too boring. Doesn't have a golf course. He likes to play golf, but of course, so did Bill Clinton. So it's probably a combination of those factors.
Well, the idea that Camp David would be used as a negotiating venue for diplomacy is an old one. And of course, Jimmy Carter made it famous with the Camp David Accords. Is it possible that it may have reached the end of its usefulness with this Gulf summit here in that there seems to be so much hesitation on the part of a lot of leaders to head up there?
There does seem to be a real hesitation. I think that may have more to do with the geopolitical configuration of the world right now than Camp David itself. As you say, Camp David has a decades-long history of being a center of negotiations and meetings between high-level officials. And it has a certain advantage in that it's very secure and it's very isolated. And that's one of the reasons why it was so successful back in 1978 when Israel and Egypt reached the Camp David Accords. They really weren't bothered by a lot of folks, you know, in the news media and others.
Did you ever go to Camp David?
I have gone to the vicinity of Camp David. In fact, many years ago, back in the late 70s, when Jimmy Carter was president, and I was a serious runner, I ran a 10-kilometer run there. And I looked to my right, and standing 5 feet to my right was President Jimmy Carter in his little shorts and shirt, planning to run the same race. And I thought, well, maybe I'll run with the president, but I was a little bit faster. So I ran my race, and then I later heard that this was the famous race in which Jimmy Carter had collapsed. And that collapse was considered to be part of the late Carter malaise during his term. But what nobody knows, and to Jimmy Carter's great credit, is that after collapsing, he returned to the finish and actually gave all of us who finished the race a wonderful, inspiring pep talk. I'll never forget that.
A little bit of history that you missed. Not much gets by you, Alan Lichtman. Thanks so much.
My great pleasure. Take care.
Alan Lichtman, a political historian, distinguished professor of history at American University.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Andrea Seymour, and I'm here enjoying Midnight Bingo. It's my first time.
1, 2, 3, 4, 69!
My name is Molly. I do like to come and play bingo. I play pretty regularly. I think a lot of people have that misconception that it's very different than it actually is.
Like a nursing home with old women sitting around going, be quiet. Just like all uptight, but this is totally different. $80!
Woo! I'll tell you, we actually have a saying for that right here for late night bingo. It is not your grandmother's bingo.
Work it out! Work it out!
You know, it's exciting. It's fun to yell bingo.
B14! Pass the bingo on B14!
You just heard Andrea Seymour and Molly Strothkamp playing Late Night Bingo at Casino Arizona and Jason Davison calling the numbers. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to tell us our luck has run out, send us a note to show at kjzz.org. Coming up, a Valley-based hip-hop group uses the reality of racial politics as inspiration for its music.
On my reservation, the Dunawatha Nation or various other Native communities that we played, that hip-hop is universal, where it's been able to connect various people that would usually not connect through music.
The music and message of Shining Soul later on the show.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. In Valley traffic, no accidents to tell you about. There is some slowing, though, on the 202 westbound from about 40th Street to about 24th Street. Look for partly sunny skies, breezy conditions for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 86 degrees. That would be 5 degrees cooler than yesterday and also cooler than average. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight. Slight chance of rain. Overnight lows in the mid-60s. Cloudy skies on the way for tomorrow. 30% chance of rain. We could see some thunderstorms as well. Look for a high of 76 degrees. 78 for a high on Saturday. It's partly sunny right now in Phoenix. 85 degrees at KJZZ at 238.
KJZZ is supported by Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust 2015 Encore Career Prize. Celebrating an inspiring individual age 50 or older, applying experience in extraordinary ways to improve social good. More at pipertrust.org/encore.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The body of an eighth victim has been pulled from the wreckage of the Amtrak crash in Philadelphia. Officials say they believe all 243 passengers and crew on board are now accounted for. NTSB investigators say a system called positive train control would have prevented the deadly derailment. Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter says the systems, though, are already installed in some places.
They've already been in the process of installing them, and that, in fact, some of those devices are already in place in parts of the Northeast Corridor and possibly either here in Philadelphia or parts of Philadelphia or near Philadelphia.
That system automatically slows trains down to the speed limit if engineers fail to do so. Amtrak officials say limited Northeast Corridor service will be restored Monday. Full service is expected by Tuesday. The person flying a small drone-type device too close to the White House this afternoon was taken into custody. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, the White House was on lockdown for about an hour.
According to the U.S. Secret Service, the small unmanned aerial vehicle was spotted flying 100 feet above Lafayette Park, right across the street from the White House. It is red and black and barely larger than a brick. According to a Secret Service statement, officers instructed the individual to land the small drone-like device, and the person complied. As a precaution, the device was swept by police and declared safe. The president was not at the White House at the time. Back in January, a larger drone crashed on the White House lawn. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street higher by the closing bell, the Dow up 191 points to close at 18,252. The Nasdaq gained 69 points to end at 5050, and the S&P 500 up 22 points, closing at 2121. That's a record close for the S&P 500. This is NPR News.
The Mexican Grey Wolf Recovery Program has been controversial since its inception, and it's not just political opposition causing issues. A lack of genetic diversity and inbreeding also pose a major threat to the species' recovery. But as KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, a complex captive breeding system and careful genetic planning is showing some promising results.
Mom, we're going back. Mom, we're going back.
The Mexican gray wolf habitat at the Phoenix Zoo is a popular place, especially today, because the pack is particularly active. For Logan Peterson, it's his first time seeing the animal up close.
I only seen one on movies, but never in real life before.
But this isn't your average zoo exhibit. These animals are being managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for potential release to the wild.
Good to go?
Yeah, I think we're good to go in. Keeper Shauna Farrington says they can't train the wolves or introduce any unnatural behaviors, meaning staff mix up their schedules so the animals don't come to expect them. It makes tasks like exhibit cleaning a tricky prospect.
One person leads and one person collects fecal material, and then the back person follows. And the people that are on the ends of the threesome, they actually make sure that the wolves aren't getting too close so that we're all safe.
The exhibit is a holding facility for four of about 240 Mexican gray wolves living in captivity around the country. Maggie Dwyer is a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The entire global population of Mexican wolves actually started with only seven wolves. We completely eradicated the Mexican wolf from the wild in the United States. In the late 1970s, we captured what may have been the last remaining wild wolves in Mexico.
She says when it comes to restoring a healthy population, working with just seven animals created a genetic bottleneck. But that wasn't the species' only problem.
We've had one particular wolf achieve such success out there that nearly all of the wild population is somehow related to her.
In other words, one female wolf supermom is somewhat related to almost all of the roughly 110 animals living in the wild right now. And that's a problem. Dwyer says in response, the agency launched an experimental and work-intensive method of genetic rehabilitation. It starts out with an annual two-day meeting where wildlife managers analyze the results of a computer program mapping out the entire population's pedigree. They're looking to find a wolf in captivity that will thrive and, more importantly, breed in the wild.
We'll look at the current genetic makeup of the wild population and then look for a wolf in captivity that would, if released to the wild, would increase gene diversity, reduce inbreeding, reduce the relatedness of the wild population.
Relatedness and inbreeding can lead to low birth weight and increased pup mortality rates, which is why captive wolves who are the least related to that one wolf supermom become candidates to reproduce and get transferred into what's known as a pre-release facility in Sevierta, New Mexico. There they get conditioned to living in a wild environment and evaluated for potential release.
You know, 1 to 2 effective migrants per generation would help us keep this population, you know, on the right trajectory genetically. So far, we've had about a 30% success rate, and our most successful type of release has been an adult pair of wolves with offspring.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Arizona Game and Fish Department have released about 95 animals to the wild since the program began in 1998, and population numbers are trending up, increasing by almost 30 animals since last year. But Dwyer says while the genetic issues are showing some signs of improvement, the species is far from out of the woods in terms of survival, as coexistence with local livestock still remains a hotly debated issue. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The U.S. Forest Service has signed a Record of Decision on the 4 Forest Restoration Initiative, also known as 4FRI. It's the biggest environmental impact statement ever written by the agency. For more on this step and how the initiative is going generally, we turn to Diane Vosick, Director of Policy and Partnerships for the Ecological Restoration Institute at NAU and 4FRI's co-chair.
The Forest Service looked across 1 million acres over here in western northern Arizona. And from that million-acre analysis, chose about 430,000 acres that are going to be thinned to restore forest health and reduce fire risk, and chose about 155,000 acres that will just be burned to reduce the fuels. So for a combination of almost 600,000 acres that will receive treatments. And this is a major watershed event.
When does that work start?
There is work starting right now. So there are some acres in northern Arizona that have been approved under an environmental impact statement already. So we have work already underway. But under this new giant environmental impact statement, we can expect the first trees to be thinned probably spring of 2016.
So that means that you still have at least one more wildfire season to get through. Before that happens, does it make you nervous the more time that goes by before that thinning happens that the area might be at risk for another massive wildfire?
I think everybody in northern Arizona is nervous every fire season. With 2 record-breaking fires since the Rodeo Chediskai in 2002 and the Walla Fire in 2011, we've burned up over 1 million acres in northern Arizona.
We've heard a lot about the potential impact on the region's economy from 4FRI, and I'm curious if those projections in your mind are accurate, that this will help the economy, will give jobs to folks, will sort of help increase industry and commerce in the area?
Absolutely. A key element of this is working with the private sector to increase the thinning and increase rural jobs and manufacturing. So back in 2012, we partnered with the W.A. Franke College of Business and did a jobs analysis to determine how the 4FRI at full operation will impact northern Arizona. That analysis came up with, and these are just jobs in the woods, not in the manufacturing sector, but there would be a minimum of 422 full-time equivalent or full-time jobs available in northern Arizona. And these are good wage jobs.
Are there rules or is there a way to determine how many residents of that area will be getting some of these jobs as opposed to companies bringing in workers from elsewhere?
Right now, the Ecological Restoration Institute has been coordinating meetings with the industry as well as community colleges and others to create the training that's necessary for local residents to get those jobs because they are skilled jobs. And I just have to point out that right now we are deficient in people who have those skills.
So how do you fix that?
Well, we need to get some training programs up and running. And some of the biggest sector jobs, interestingly enough, are people with commercial driver's licenses that can drive the big trucks that are necessary to move slash and other products from forest thinning around not only on Forest Service roads, but to the manufacturing destinations and markets beyond. And there's an acute shortage of people with commercial driver's licenses.
Why do you think it is that these kinds of programs haven't been in place? I mean, 4FRY is not a brand new program. It's been talked about and sort of in process for a little while now.
We actually, a bunch of institutions made a run at trying to create a training program several years ago. But the fact of the matter is there wasn't enough thinning activity underway to justify creation of these programs.
Diane Vosick is Director of Policy and Partnerships for the Ecological Restoration Institute at NAU and a co-chair of 4FRY. Diane, thank you so much.
Happy to be here.
Tomorrow, the north rim of the Grand Canyon reopens to visitors after closing for the winter in early December. Robin Tellis is district ranger with the Division of Interpretation and Resource Education at the North Rim. She's one of the few people who's there year-round.
You know, it varies every year throughout the winter. There can be five or six people here, or there could be a half a dozen or a dozen. And sometimes you're the only person here. And then when the season starts up, we've got about 70 Park Service employees and a couple hundred concessionaire employees.
Do you look forward to the reopening of the season? Do you also enjoy some of the aspects of being there in the off season? Can you just give me kind of the pros and cons of that?
It's great to be here in the wintertime with all the snow, and it's so quiet, and it's a beautiful place. And, you know, we have basically, this is our backyard because we live here. But by the time winter is over, we're ready for people again, and it's a little bit of a sort of a culture shock, I guess you could say, because, you know, going from 612 people to thousands, you know, just overnight, it can be a little tough, but we always look forward to having more people around.
What are some of the things that need to be done to maintain the area year-round? I mean, are there sort of basic standard things that you have to do?
Yeah, a big reason why we need to close in the wintertime is the water and sewer lines. You know, they were put in years ago, so they're old, and they're not buried very deep. And with the cold temperatures, they freeze and break, and so it's not something that we can rely on. Oh, we get a lot of snow here, so, you know, even if the state was to plow the highway on a regular basis to get in here, it drifts. So they can make a track in and turn around to go back the other way, and it will all be filled in again in various places throughout the road on the highway.
Robin, can you describe for me maybe what an average day would be like in the off-season and then an average day for you once visitors come back?
Yeah, in the off-season, we're on a regular snow year. We're digging a lot of snow. You know, the snow is up over our roofs, so we have to dig tunnels through the windows and the doors to make sure we can get out and about and have some sunshine. If you want to go anywhere during the wintertime, you have to have skis or snowshoes on, or otherwise you're post-holing. We have a 52-mile snowmobile ride to get to Jacob Lake, and that's where we keep our vehicles. So it can be 2 to 4 hours of snowmobiling each way just to go get in your car and go somewhere. And then when spring comes, we're all pretty happy to see dirt again, so we can walk and just put our tennis shoes on.
You clearly love what you do. You also sound like kind of a fairly mellow person. I wonder, are you, and does it take that when you have such a change in lifestyle from season to season?
Yeah, you do kind of just have to, you know, roll with the punches, because you never know what's going to happen up here. It could be severe weather, it could be fire. And we're a small community, so we all work together to make things happen.
Robin Tellis, District Ranger with the Division of Interpretation and Resource Education at the North Rim of the Grand Canyon. Robin, thanks, and good luck with the season.
Yeah, thank you.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Checking Valley traffic. I-10 eastbound, an accident blocks the shoulder at 67th Avenue. On the 101 southbound in the East Valley, an accident at Broadway blocks the shoulder there. Look for partly sunny skies, breezy conditions this afternoon with a high of 86 degrees. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight with a slight chance for rain, overnight lows in the mid-60s. Mostly cloudy skies tomorrow, 30% chance of rain, could see some thunderstorms as well. Look for a high of 76 degrees. Chance of rain continues into Saturday with a high of 78. Right now, it's partly sunny, 85 degrees at KJZZ at 253.
KJZZ is supported by the Maricopa Community Colleges Foundation, announcing the Campaign for Student Success, benefiting the 10 Maricopa Community Colleges. Donation information is available at mcccdf.org/student.
Rap and hip-hop have often been used as a way to get across messages about racial and social justice. Arizona-based Shining Soul has used frustration with U.S. border policy and the immigration enforcement law SB 1070 as inspiration for their music. We spoke with Shining Soul MCs Franco Habre and Alex Soto. So is there a message, a consistent message that Shining Soul goes with? Is there some sort of theme that you guys really practice a lot in the music you do?
And overall, that hip-hop is resistance. You know, it may not be, or the mainstream may not present it as that, but I mean, there's still conscious hip hop out, you know, here in Arizona, and not just like in the scene here locally. It's everywhere, you know, on reservations, on my reservation, the Thonautha Nation, or various other Native communities that we played. That hip hop is universal, where it's been able to connect various people that would usually not connect through music.
Young, gifted, and brown. I said we're doing it now. We be putting it down with that profound sound. We infinity bound to the top. Keep your ears to the ground.
Alex, were there any specific experiences you had being from a reservation where people really misconstrued you, misunderstood you, and that made you even more want to be an artist in that sense?
Well, a lot of what we speak on, at least on my side of the issues, is around the border issues happening here in the so-called U.S. and with the issues of like border patrol checkpoints, like being young, seeing that, witnessing it firsthand, being scrutinized, just going back home or coming up here to Phoenix or wherever, and having to prove who you are, and you're like, this is our land, literally.
Up in the city, y'all know the deal. But back on my reservation, it's been the ordeal. Red light, blue light, keep still. Checking for ID, you get the ideal.
Being in that situation where you're frustrated and you're angry and you want to say more at the time, but you want to get by and not, you know, be held up any longer. So, you know, going through that, and then also at the same time hearing like a Public Enemy, an NWA, or Mos Def, or Common, and so forth, a lot of the hip hop I grew up on, it helped me see that there's an outlet to be able to share that frustration and, you know, be able to make it in a way, create it in a way that many people can also relate to. Mm-hmm. So,
impact of SB 1070 on your creativity?
Oh, I mean, that was like a call to action for us as far as, you know, being where we come from and talking about the specificity about that, you know, that draconian law, that, you know, racist law, which is just like a, you know, just a symptom of like a larger context of like colonization and that domination factor with, you know, these institutionalized elements of like racism, classism, homophobia, you know, all these pillars of like oppression that exist. So that was just kind of a way to like talk about those things and not solely focus on the law itself and or one political like villain, like our pile, so to speak. It's more like there's like many of those individuals and laws that have been in construction for years. So like, I mean, there was a way to put it in rhyme, but I'm saying now and breaking it down so people can like, you know, feel it and hear it and know that it's like kind of it's that crucial that we attack that and its roots, where it comes from, but also to like give light to like in a deconstructed way to talk about it in a hip-hop lyrical form.
We from that home of the decent pleasant, house of the insurrection, where 1070 meets 180 shit. Then no love for brown complexion, silence is acquiescence, where non-violence protects and serves the 1%.
When it was passed, pretty much the way I took it was that it was an extension of what I was witnessing already on the reservation, because on my community, since roughly the mid-90s, our community's been militarized. It's been affected by, you know, this surveillance, society, you know, where we have drones, we have checkpoints, we have this mass militarization across the border. And in my community, the Thonautha Nation, which straddles 78 miles of the border, you know, has been going for all these years. So when SB 1070 came around, it pretty much, you know, was to me, it was like, oh, it's the same thing now. It's just going to be outside the res. It's going to be off in the cities and across the whole state of Arizona. So it's just an expansion of what I was already seeing. So a lot of what was happening then, you know, a lot of the non-musical work that we do, you know, I was trying to express that that voice and let people know it's like it's all connected, you know, and there's definitely a bigger plan, as you know, Franco touched on. So regarding our communities being attacked, so through hip hop, I felt the need that we need to speak on it, because you know there's a lot of artists at the time that were speaking on it, but not very coming from the place that I was coming from, and myself as a native, indigenous person, I wanted to share that in the music, but also keeping it true to the roots of hip hop and be able to have it universal.
Alex Soto and Franco Abre of Shining Soul will be performing on Sunday night at the Phoenix Youth Hostel and Cultural Center.
The art of burlesque can be described a lot of ways. Sultry, flashy, provocative, quirky.
Let's get a little more explanation. The show's Anika Klein spoke with a burlesque performer who's starting her own show. Oh, and by the way, Mark, she's looking for new talent.
Oh, no.
Amy Blackwood got her start as a burlesque performer in New York City, where she developed her onstage persona, Lady Lily Levamp.
As Amy, I'm just kind of like, oh, really kind of dorky and shy and goofy. But I feel as Lily, I'm like a goddess.
Blackwood started Hump Day Burlesque at Lost Leaf Bar in downtown Phoenix last month. And now she's recruiting. She says the stage is open to anyone of all shapes, sizes, gender identities.
Anything. I'm just looking for people with the creativity and the desire and the passion to perform.
Including a special guest at the last show. A snake, charmed from a basket by one performer. New and experienced performers craft their own costumes and makeup and test the routine on the crowd. Blackwood hopes some of those audience members will want to become performers themselves, like Alexis Edmonds, a musician in the audience who hopes to try burlesque for the first time next month.
I'm used to performing on stage by myself, so that won't be weird, but obviously I usually keep my clothes on.
Blackwood hopes that new performers will feel empowered through burlesque and have the courage to try new things on stage.
I told people, just if you want to experiment with something, come here and do it.
A mix of theatrical performance and striptease, Hump Day Burlesque is a 21 and up show, so consider this a blush warning. The next one is at Lost Leaf on Wednesday. It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
Be sure to be with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 for the show. Scottsdale's losing another piece of the Old West, and the Phoenix City Council prepares to vote on a new city budget. Those stories and much, much more tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show.
And if you're looking for something to do tonight and you really like Judy Garland, you can see The Wizard of Oz at 7 p.m. at the Don Bluth Front Row Theater in Scottsdale, and you can also see The End of the Rainbow. That's tonight at 8 at Phoenix Theater.
You can also check out Lana Del Rey. She'll be performing tonight at Auction Pavilion in Phoenix.
For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony, presenting a stirring production of Oliver, performed by Phoenix Theater alongside the Symphony at Symphony Hall, May 29th through 31st. Info at phoenixsymphony.org.